and bag, taking a photograph from one of the side pockets and handing it across to me.
"He looks like him, doesn't he?"
she asked quietly, and I nodded. "He looks like how he looked when we were teenagers. They're very alike.
But there's someone else there, too."
"Who?"
I frowned, shaking my head.
"I'm not sure," I said. "There's something in his expression that reminds me of someone, but for the life of me I can't think who. He isn't like Julian in temperament, though. Liam is much more quiet, more reserved, almost shy. Do you think he'd be interested in meeting me? Would you allow it?"
"No," she said firmly. "At least not until he's 18. And I'd ask you to respect my wishes. He has his exams coming up, and I don't want any more trauma in his life right now. He'll be 18 in a year's time, and you can see him then.
But please don't argue with me, Cyril.
But I want to see him."
"And you can. When he's 18. But not a day before."
"Tell me you won't go behind my back on this. You owe me that much at least." I took a deep breath. She was right, of course.
"All right," I said. "And there's one other thing," she said.
"Go on."
"When you meet him, from the first day that the two of you talk, you have to be completely honest with him. No lies. You have to tell him who you are. You have to tell him everything about yourself."
Which is what I did.
1 year later, 10 days after his 18th birthday, when Alice introduced us for the first time, and we went for a walk along Dunleary Pier together, and I told him the story of my life from the day that I'd come downstairs in the house on Dartmouth Square, the house in which he now lived, to find his Uncle Julian sitting in the hallway, through to the world that had slowly unfolded for me and the realizations I'd had about myself. I talked to him about why I had married his mother, why I had left her, and how badly I felt about what I had done. I talked about my life in Amsterdam and New York, about Ignac and Bastian, about how he had been killed by a group of thugs who had seen us embracing in Central Park, and how nothing had ever quite seemed as bright for me since. And through it all he listened and barely spoke, and seemed shocked at times, embarrassed at others. And finally, when we parted, I went to shake his hand, but he refused it and walked off to catch the Dart back into town. In the 2 years between then and now, he had thawed a little towards me, and we saw each other occasionally, but there was still nothing like the affection or love that I imagined should exist between a father and son. And while he didn't seem to want me to leave his life, he never picked a fight, for example, or attacked me for not being part of his childhood. He seemed unwilling at the same time to allow me to involve myself in it either, appearing distrustful of me on the occasions that we met, which were few and far between. But then this, I told myself, was the bed that I had made for myself. There was no one else that I could blame.
"Goal!" roared Jimmy and Liam together in the 11th minute, as Ray Houghton hit a shot past the head of Pauluka and the ball landed in the top right corner of the net. The whole of Doheny and Nesbitt's exploded in cheers, pints were knocked over left, right and centre, and there was much hugging and dancing around. The two boys embraced each other, jumping up and down in delight, but I stayed where I was, smiling and applauding, feeling unable to rise to my feet and behave as others were doing, and not just because I would have looked ridiculous with my crutch.
"We're going to win this,"
said Jimmy, practically hovering off the stool in delight.
"The Italians are too cocky by half."
"Will you be going on celebrating somewhere if we do?"
I asked, and Liam turned to look at me.
"We will," he said, "but you can't come with us. We'll be out with our uni friends."
"I never asked to come with you," I said. "I was only asking, that's all. And I was only saying, all right."
And we left it at that and turned our attention back to the screen. The players were coming to the sidelines now and asking for bottles of water. The heat was too much for them. There was war on the pitch. Jack Charlton running on and complaining to the referee, substitutes pacing up and down in frustration. It looked as if the thing was going to end badly for everyone.
Date night.
I had given no thought to romance,
since Bastian's death, and so it came as something of a surprise to me when I got asked out on a date. The man in question, 15 years younger than me and quite attractive, which did my ego no harm whatsoever, was a TD in Dáil Éireann and a regular user of the library, unlike most of his colleagues, who generally sent their assistants down to do their donkey work for them. He'd always been quite talkative and friendly, but I had put this down to an affable temperament on his part, until the afternoon when he inquired whether I was doing anything that Thursday night.
"Nothing that I know of," I said. "Why do you need to use the library late?"
"Oh, Christ, no," he said, shaking his head and looking at me as if I was half mad.
"Nothing like that. I just wondered whether I could tempt you out for a drink, that's all."
"A drink?" I asked, unsure whether I had heard him correctly. "How do you mean?"
"You know, two people sitting down in a bar, having a couple of pints and a chat. You do drink, don't you?"
"I do, yes," I said. "I mean, not to excess, but so.
How about it?"
"Do you mean just the two of us?"
"Jesus, Cyril, I feel like I'm negotiating an EC treaty here."
"Yes, just the two of us."
"Oh. All right, then.
Where were you thinking of?"
"Somewhere discreet," he said.
"What does that mean?" I asked. And perhaps that should have been my first clue that our night out together would not end well.
"Do you know the yellow house in Rathfarnham?" he asked.
"I do," I said. "I haven't been there in years. Would somewhere in the city centre not be easier?"
"Let's go to the yellow house," he said. "Thursday night, 8 o'clock.
"No, that's the night of Mrs. Goggin's retirement party."
"Who?"
he asked. "Mrs. Goggin from the tea room. She's retiring after almost 50 years here." He looked a little blank.
"So what?" he said. "You're not planning on going along, are you?"
"Of course I am."
"Why?"
"Because, like I just told you, she's retiring after almost..."
Yep.
He thought about it.
"Do you think I should go too?"
"How do you mean?"
"Well, it would have meant a lot to her if I showed my face."
I stared at him, trying to decipher his meaning.
"Because you're a TD," I asked.
"Is that what you're getting at?"
"Yes."
I shook my head. "I honestly don't think she'll care one way or the other."
"I'd say she would," he said, looking half offended. "Well, I'm going anyway, so Thursday's out."
"Fine," he said, with a dramatic sigh, as if he was a frustrated teenager and not a grown man. "Friday night, then."
"No, wait. I can't do Friday night. Constituency dinner. And weekends are out for obvious reasons. How's Monday?"
"Monday's good," I said, unsure what the obvious reasons were. "Will we just go from here when I lock up the library?"
"No.
Let's meet there."
"What, at the yellow house?"
"Yes."
"But if we're both going to be in the Dáil, wouldn't it be easier if we..."
"I don't know what Monday night might have in store," he said.
"It'll be easier if we just meet there."
"All right." In the intervening days, I gave a lot of thought to what I might wear. The truth was that I had no real idea what I was letting myself in for. I had long guessed that the man was gay, but he was so much younger than me that I couldn't quite believe that he would be interested in someone my age. At the retirement party, I confided my dilemma to Mrs. Goggin, who seemed delighted by my quandary.
"Good for you," she said. "I'm delighted for you, Cyril. You're far too young to be giving up on meeting someone new."
"I don't really see it like that," I told her. "And I'm not lonely. I know that's what lonely people generally say, but I'm really not. I'm happy with my life just the way it is."
"Who was it anyway?" she asked. "Which TD?"
I told her his name.
"Oh," she said, her face falling a little.
"What?"
"Nothing."
"No, go on, tell me."
"I don't want to put you off him."
"I'm not particularly on him. It's just a date."
"Well,
he just seems like a sneaky sort to me," she said.
"He strolls in here as if he owns the place and tries to sit at the tables with the ministers without going through me first. The swagger on him, and him only in the place a wet weekend. I've thought about putting him out a few times."
I learned long ago from Mrs. Hennessy, she was the woman who hired me back in the 40s, that if I didn't put my foot down with the TDs from the start, they'd use their country boots to walk all over me. And I've put that advice to good use ever since. You run a tight ship here, that's for sure.
I had to.
You'd see less bad behavior in a kindergarten.
So you don't think I should go?
I didn't say that. Just be careful of them. That's my advice to you. I remember you told me that you lost your friend some years ago.
I did, yes, I said.
Bastian. And to be honest, in the 7 years since then, I've never had any great longing for sex or a partner. Sorry, you don't mind me being so blunt, do you?
Go ahead, she said. Remember, I brought tea up to Charlie Hottie's office for 30 years, so I've seen and heard a lot worse.
I suppose I felt for a long time that that side of my life is over, I said.
And do you want it to be?
I had to think about it. I don't know, I said. It's never brought me anything but torment. Well, at least until I met Bastian anyway. I don't think I can start over with someone new. But maybe there's a little fire still inside me somewhere. Which is why I'm fretting about the whole thing. But anyway, I shouldn't be talking about this tonight. It's your night.
You have a great turnout all the same. Our heads turned in unison to look around the room.
Practically everyone who worked in the Dáil had shown up, and the Taoiseach, Albert Reynolds, had given a good speech earlier. My TD friend had popped his head in for 20 minutes, but, despite standing quite close to me at one point, had completely ignored me, even when I said hello.
I do,
she said, sounding pleased. I'll miss the place.
Would you believe I haven't had a single sick day in 49 years?
Albert said that earlier. I thought he was making it up.
It's as true as I'm sitting here.
So what will you do? I asked. Is there a Mr. Goggin somewhere who'd be happy to have you at home for a change? She shook her head.
There isn't, she said. There was never a Mr. Goggin.
A long time ago a priest stood on the altar of a church in West Cork and told me that I'd never find a husband. I thought he was just being a sanctimonious old prig, but as it turns out, he was right. Sure, I even had to pretend that I was a widow to get the job here.
Why?
I asked.
Different times, she said.
She took a deep breath and looked around to make sure we weren't being overheard. I was about to have a baby, you see. So I said my husband had been killed in the war. Mrs. Hennessy knew the truth, but if anyone else had found out, I'd have been out the door in a flash.
Bunch of charmers, aren't they? I said.
The priests. I've never set any store by them, she told me. Not since that day. Anyway, I've done well enough all these years without a husband.
And your son? I asked. How is he doing?
My son? She asked, her smile fading a little. Jonathan, isn't it?
Oh, Jonathan. Sorry,
Yes, he's grand.
Well, he was a little sick over the last year or so, but he's better now. He has a couple of kids of his own, so I'll be able to help out a little more there now that my time will be my own. I'm looking forward to that, at least.
Before she could say any more, one of the girls from the tea room came over and interrupted us, asking Mrs. Goggin whether she would come over and join them all for a photograph.
Oh, I take a terrible photograph, she said. I always end up looking angry in them.
We need one for the wall, insisted the girl. After all your years of service.
Come on, Mrs. Goggin. We'll all be in it with you.
She sighed and stood up, nodding her head.
All right, she said. One last duty before I'm free.
And look, you should go on that date, Cyril, she added, turning back to me.
But just be careful of that fella. That's all I'm saying.
I will, I said.
And good luck to you in your retirement if I don't see you later.
To my surprise, she reached down and kissed me on the cheek and gave me a curious look before the young girl dragged her away. A few days later, I arrived as planned in the yellow house and found my date sitting in a corner with his back to the room as if he didn't want anyone to notice him.
Andrew,
I said, taking the seat opposite him with a full view of the room.
I almost missed you there. It's like you're hiding away from the world.
Not at all,
he replied, laughing and ordering me a drink from one of the lads passing by.
How are you, Cyril? How's work today?
Grand, I said, which led to the usual exchange of pleasantries for 20 minutes or so before I decided to get to the heart of things. Can I just ask, I said, and forgive me if this sounds ridiculous, but I was a little surprised when you invited me out in the first place. Is this just a friendship thing, or is there something else?
It can be anything we want it to be, he replied with a shrug. We're grown men, after all, and we've always got along, haven't we?
That's true, I said. You do know that I'm gay, right?
Of course I do, he said. I wouldn't have asked you out otherwise.
Oh, right, I said.
So you're gay too, then? I wasn't sure. I assumed, but...
Here's the thing, Cyril, he said, leaning in a little. I'm not really comfortable with labels, you know?
They're so defining.
Well, yes, I agreed. I mean, that is what labels do by their nature. They define things.
Exactly. And it's 1994, not the 50s. I feel like we should be past all that type of thing by now.
I suppose, I said. Sorry, what do you mean? What type of thing?
Labels. Oh,
right, okay.
Anyway, tell me about you, he said. Are you married or anything?
No, I said, deciding not to get into the technicalities of the completely honest answer.
Why would I be married?
I just told you I'm gay.
But that doesn't mean anything. You work on the doll, for Christ's sake. Throw a stick, as they say.
I suppose I've heard the odd rumour, I admitted.
So, if you're not married, are you seeing anyone right now?
No one special.
Anyone who isn't special?
Actually, no, I said, shaking my head. I'm not seeing anyone at all, and I haven't in a long time. I was with someone for many years, but he died in 1987.
All right, he said, pulling back a little.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Do you mind if I ask how he died?
We were both attacked in Central Park, I explained.
I survived.
He didn't. The crutch is what I was left with.
I'm sorry,
he repeated. And now he leaned back in, a gesture whose meaning was all too obvious to me. It's all right, I said. I miss him, of course, a great deal. We should have had a long future together yet, and that was stolen from us. But I've come to terms with it. Life happens, and death happens.
Do you know something? I added, a thought coming into my head. I've just realized that I'm 49 years old, and yet this is the first time I've ever gone on a date in Ireland with another man.
He frowned a little, and took a long drink from his beer.
You're in your 50s? He asked. I thought you were younger than that.
I stared at him, wondering whether he was a little hard of hearing.
No, I said. I'm 49. I just said. Yes, but you don't mean that you're really 49, do you?
What else would I mean?
Jesus, you've been off the date and seen quite a while, haven't you?
The thing is, most men looking for other men claim to be younger than they really are, especially older men. If you meet a man from a person, lad, and he says he's in his late 30s, that means he's pushing 50 and thinks he can get away with 39. Delusional, most of them, but you know, whatever. When you said you're 49, I assumed that meant you were mid to late 50s in real life.
No,
I said, shaking my head. I really am 49. I was born a few months after the war ended.
Which war?
The Second World War?
Oh, that one.
Well, not the first.
No, obviously not. You'd be like 100 then.
Well, not quite. Close enough.
Do you meet a lot of people from person, lads? I asked, wondering how he had done in history at school.
From time to time, he said. I met a lad a couple of weeks ago. He said he was 19, but when he showed up, he was almost my own age. He was wearing a blondie T-shirt, for Christ's sake.
I used to have one of those, I said.
But why would you want to meet someone who you thought was 19 anyway?
Why wouldn't I? He said, laughing. I'm not too old for a 19-year-old.
Well, I suppose that's a matter of opinion. But what would you have in common with a boy that age?
We don't need to have anything in common. It wasn't his conversational skills that I was after.
I nodded.
feeling a little uncomfortable. "Anyway, it just seems surprising to me, that's all," I said. "If you're attracted to younger men, then why did you ask me out?"
"Because I'm attracted to you too."
"I'm attracted to lots of people." "Okay," I said, trying to process this and wishing for all the world that Bastian was sitting across from me drinking a beer and not this tosser. "So how old are you?" I asked finally.
34. "So does that mean you're really 34? "It does. But I'm 28 when I meet people."
"You're meeting me right now."
"Yeah, but that's different. You're older, so I can be my own age."
"Right. And have you had many relationships?"
"Relationships? No,"
he said with a shrug.
"That's not really where my focus has been over the last 10 years or so."
"Where has your focus been?"
"Look, I'm a normal guy, Cyril. I like getting laid."
"Fair enough."
"Don't you like getting laid?"
"Of course. I mean, I did. Once."
"When was the last time?" 7 years ago."
He put his pint down and stared at me, his eyes opening wide.
"Are you fucking kidding me?"
he asked. "I told you, that's when Bastian died."
"Yeah, but you're telling me that you haven't had sex since then?"
"Is that so strange?"
"It's fucking weird is what it is."
I said nothing. I wondered whether he realized how rude he was being.
"You must be fucking gagging for it,"
he said, his voice rising a little. And I noticed a couple at the next table looking at us in disdain. Some things didn't change.
"I'm not really," I said quietly.
"Yeah, you are."
"No, I'm not." "If you really are 49, then you're way too young to be closing up shop."
"I am 49, I insisted. "And funnily enough, you're the second person to say something along those lines to me over the last few days."
"Who was the first?"
"Mrs. Goggin."
"Who's Mrs. Goggin?"
I rolled my eyes. "I told you before, the lady from the tea room."
"What tea room?"
"In Dáil Éireann." "Oh, yeah, you said something about her before. She was retiring, wasn't she?"
"Yes.
You were there."
"Oh, that's right. I remember now. I think it made her night when I showed up, but I couldn't say."
"I said hello to you and you ignored me?"
"Didn't see you."
"Did she do it anyway?"
"Did she do what?"
"Retire."
"Yes, of course she did. Why else would she have a retirement party?"
"I don't know," he said. "Lots of people say they're retired, but they never do. Look at Frank Sinatra."
"Well, she has," I told him, growing exhausted now by the conversation. "Anyway,
I suppose you're single, are you?"
"What makes you think that?"
"The fact that you asked me out."
"Oh, yeah," he said. "Well, sort of."
"What does that mean?"
"It means I'm open to offers,"
he replied, grinning at me. "If anyone wants to make one." "I'll be back in a minute," I said, taking the opportunity to go to the bathroom for a few moments to myself. When I came back, there were two more beers on the table, and I reconciled myself to the fact that I would have to stay a little longer. "I'd say it's a lot different now," I said, sitting down and hoping to start a sensible conversation with him.
"Being gay in Ireland, I mean.
When I was younger, it was near impossible. I had a terrible time of it, to be honest. It's easier these days, I imagine."
"It's not, actually," he said quickly. "The laws are still against us. You still can't walk down the street holding a man's hand without risking getting your head caved in. There's a few more bars, I suppose. It's not just George anymore, and things aren't quite as underground as they once were, but no, I don't think it's any easier. Maybe it's not hard to meet people, though. You find a few things online sometimes. The odd chat room or dating page."
"On what?" I asked.
"Online."
"What does that mean? On what line?"
"The World Wide Web. Have you not heard of it?"
"A little bit," I said. "It's the future," he told me. "One day we'll all be online."
"Doing what?"
"I don't know. Looking stuff up."
"Sounds great," I said. "Can't wait."
"My point is that it's not much better than it used to be, but maybe it'll get there. We need some serious changes to the law, but that'll take time." "If only we knew somebody who worked in politics," I said. "Someone who could make a stand and get the ball rolling."
"I hope you're not thinking of me. That's a vote loser.
I wouldn't touch something like that with a barge pole. Anyway, kids these days are a lot more comfortable in their own skin. They actually come out to people, which is a very 90s thing to do, if you ask me. Did you ever come out to your parents?
I never knew them, I told him. I was adopted.
Well, your adoptive parents, then. My adoptive mother died when I was just a child, I said. I never actually told my adoptive father that I was gay, but due to a set of circumstances which I won't bore you with right now, he found out when I was 28. He never really cared, to be honest. He's an odd fish in many ways, but he doesn't have a bigger bone in his body. What about you? My mother's dead too, he said. And my father has Alzheimer's, so there's no point.
Right, I said. And what about your brothers and sisters? Have you told them?
No, he said. I don't think they'd understand.
Are they older or younger than you?
Older brother, younger sister.
But that generation, your generation, they don't care so much about these things, do they? Why don't you just tell them?
He shrugged.
That's complicated, he said. I'd rather not go into it.
All right. Shall we have another drink? Go on, so.
While he was at the bar, I watched him, unable to decide whether my being here was a good or bad idea. I found him slightly obnoxious, but I also couldn't deny the fact that I found him physically attractive, and as I started to realize, that spark inside me hadn't quite died away yet, as much as I tried to extinguish the flame. The fact that he'd been interested enough to ask me out in the first place had been flattering to me. He'd only been elected to the Dáil at the most recent election, but there was a lot of talk about him being a potential future minister. He'd made some good speeches, impressed his party's leadership, and was a regular on the current affairs shows. At the next reshuffle, he was almost guaranteed a junior ministry at least. And that would be a first, I realized. A gay man rising through the ranks of Irish politics. De Valera would turn in his grave. And still, with all of that ahead of him, he'd asked me out. "Why did you choose the Yellow House?" I asked, when he sat down again. "You live over on the north side, don't you?"
"I do," he said. "So why over here?" "I thought it'd be more convenient for you."
"Sure, I live on Pembroke Road," I said. "We could have gone to the Waterloo or somewhere." "I don't like drinking in my own constituency," he said, changing his answer. "People come up to me all the time over there and ask me about potholes and electricity charges and will I come to their kids' sports day at school to hand out the medals, and you know, I really couldn't give a fuck about any of that stuff."
"But isn't that the job of a TD?"
"Well, it's part of it," he admitted. "But not the part I'm interested in."
"So what part are you interested in?"
"Climbing the ladder. Reaching the highest rung that I can."
"And doing what?"
"What do you mean?" "I mean, when you get to the top of the ladder, what's it all for? You can't just want to have power for its own sake, surely."
"Why not?"
"In the end, I want to be Taoiseach. And I'm pretty sure that I can go all the way. I have the brains, I have the ability, and the party's behind me."
"But why?" I asked. "What do you actually want to achieve in politics?"
He shook his head.
"Look, sir," he said. "Don't get me wrong. I want to do the right thing by my constituents and by the country. I mean, that would be, you know, great, I suppose. But can you think of any other profession where you'd ask such a question? If I was starting off as a teacher in a school and I said I'd like to be principal one day, you'd say, good for you. If I was a postman and said I'd like to run on post, you'd say that you admired my ambition.
Why can't it be the same with politics?
Why can't I just seek advancement and try to get to the top, and then when I'm there, if I can do something positive with it, then that's great. And if I can't, sure, I'll just enjoy being the top man."
I thought about it. On one hand, his argument sounded ridiculous, but on the other, it was difficult to identify its flaws.
"You realize it'll be difficult, though, don't you?" I said. "Being gay, I mean, I don't know whether Ireland is even ready for a gay minister yet, let alone a gay Taoiseach. Like I said, I don't put labels on myself. And of course, there are ways around these things."
I nodded, uncertain whether I really wanted to stay in his company much longer, when a thought popped into my mind. It was like a light bulb moment. "Can I ask you a question?" I said.
"Sure."
"You don't have a girlfriend, by any chance, do you?" He sat back and seemed surprised by what I'd asked.
"Of course I do," he said. "Why wouldn't I?" I'm a good-looking man with a great job in the prime of my life.
I shook my head.
You have a girlfriend, I said, more of a statement than anything else. So I presume she doesn't care about your lack of labels either.
How do you mean?
Does she think you're straight?
That's kind of a personal question, don't you think?
Well, you asked me out, Andrew, and we're here on a date, so I don't think it's unreasonable of me to ask.
He thought about it for a moment and shrugged his shoulders.
Well, she's never asked any questions, he said. And sure, what she doesn't know won't hurt her.
Oh, for God's sake, I said.
What? Next thing you'll be telling me that you're getting married.
We are getting married, as it happens, he said.
Next July. I think I can get Albert and Kathleen to come to the reception if I play my cards right.
I started laughing.
You're some chancer, I said. Why on earth are you marrying this poor girl if you're gay?
I told you, I'm not into labels, I know. But let's use one just for a moment. Why are you marrying her if you're gay?
Because I need a wife, he said unapologetically. My constituents expect that of me. The party expects that of me. There's no way that I'm going anywhere unless I have a wife and children.
And what about her? I asked.
Aware of the hypocrisy in my outrage, but, in fairness, it had been 21 years since my own wedding day, and I hadn't deceived a single person about my sexuality since then.
What about her? What do you mean?
You're going to ruin some girl's life because you don't have the guts to tell the truth about yourself.
How will I be ruining her life?
He asked, looking genuinely baffled. If I go all the way, we'll be on state visits to Buckingham Palace and the White House and all sorts of places. Are you saying that's a wasted life? It is if the person you're with doesn't love you.
But I do love her. She's a terrific person. And she loves me too.
Right, I said. I'll take your word for it.
I don't know what you're so worried about, he said. No one's asking you to marry her.
True, I said.
Look,
to each their own. Do whatever makes you happy. Shall we finish these up anyway and get out of here?
He smiled and nodded.
Fair enough, he said. We can't go back to mine, though.
You live alone, though, right?
Yes, I said.
Why?
Will we go there?
Why would we go there? What do you think?
I stared at him. You're not actually expecting us to spend the night together, are you? I asked.
No, of course not, he said. Not the full night, anyway. A couple of hours, that's all.
No thanks, I said, shaking my head.
Are you kidding me?
He asked, looking utterly confused now.
No, not at all. Well, why not?
Firstly, because we barely know each other.
Oh, like that's a big deal.
No, maybe not. But you have a girlfriend. Sorry, you have a fiancé. Who doesn't need to know anything about this?
I don't do that, Andrew, I said.
Not anymore.
Do what?
I'm not interested in being part of a deception. I spent enough of my life lying to people and hiding away. I'm not going down that road again.
Cyril, he said,
smiling in such a way that made me know he believed his charm would always work. Not to put too fine a point on it, but you're supposedly 49 years old. I'm only 34 and I'm offering it to you on a plate. Are you really telling me that you're going to turn this opportunity down?
Afraid so, I said. Sorry.
There was a long pause while he took this in, and then he simply shook his head and laughed.
All right, he said, standing up. I'll leave you to it, so. What a complete waste of an evening. You blew up big time, my friend. That's all I'm saying. And for what it's worth, I have a massive cock.
I'm delighted for you.
You sure you don't want to change your mind?
Believe me, I'm completely sure.
You're a loss.
But look. He leaned over now and looked me directly in the eye. If you ever tell anyone about this conversation, not only will I deny everything, but I'll sue you for libel.
A libel is written down, I told him. If I tell someone, then it would be a slander. Although it wouldn't be anyway, since it would be the truth.
Fuck you, he said. Don't mess with me, all right? Remember, I know some pretty powerful people.
That job of yours could be taken away from you without much difficulty.
Just go if you're going, I said wearily. I have no intention of talking to anyone about this. The whole thing is just embarrassing. You don't have to worry.
Right, he said, putting on his coat. Well, you've been warned. Go,
I said. And he went.
I ordered another drink and sat quietly in the corner of the bar, watching the couples and the groups of friends enjoying their evenings. And nothing changes, I thought. Nothing ever changes. Not in Ireland.
A real Avery.
A month before he was due to finish his sentence, Charles was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumour and released from prison early on compassionate grounds. With no desire to return to his solitary penthouse apartment in Ball's Bridge, he begged me to allow him to spend his final weeks in the house on Dartmouth Square, where he claimed, somewhat improbably, he had spent the happiest days of his life. I explained that I hadn't lived there in 40 years, but he seemed to think that I was just being difficult, and so I found myself phoning Alice to explain the predicament. 3 years after our testy reunion in the Duke, we were on slightly better terms, and to my delight she agreed immediately, finding a wonderful opportunity to remind me how good Charles had been to her after I had walked out on our reception, humiliated her in front of all her friends and family, left her alone to bring up her child, and generally ruined her life.
"I'm glad you don't hold a grudge," I told her.
"Shut up, Cyril."
"No, really. You're a very easygoing person. How some man didn't snap you up years ago is beyond me."
"Is that supposed to be a joke?" she asked.
"It was," I admitted.
As I heard the words coming out of my mouth, they sounded less amusing than I thought they would. "Some people just shouldn't try to be funny. Well, joking aside, I do appreciate it." "I think it's the least my family owes him," she said. "Max bought the house for far below market value when Charles was incarcerated the first time around. And let's face it, it was partly Max's fault that he got locked up at all. But the house will be Liam's eventually, and he's Charles's grandson as much as he was Max's. There's just one thing that you should beware of. Has Liam told you that I've made a few changes to my living situation?"
"No," I said. "He's not answering my calls at the moment."
"Why not?"
"I've no idea. He seems to hate me again."
"Why? What did you do?"
"Nothing, as far as I'm aware. It's possible that he took a remark I made about his girlfriend the wrong way."
"What did you say, and which girlfriend?"
"The Julia one?"
"I asked whether it was trendy for girls not to shave their legs or armpits anymore."
"Oh, Cyril. Although you're right. She's like a gorilla."
"So what did he say?"
"He said that only old people use the word trendy."
"Well, that's true, too. The correct term is with it. Do you know, I really don't think it is.
Cyril, I'm a university lecturer. I'm around young people all day, every day. I think I know the lingo."
"Still," I said doubtfully,
"with it does not sound any more with it than trendy. And I don't think people say lingo anymore either. Anyway, for whatever reason, Liam seemed to take offence at what I'd said. I don't know why. I wasn't trying to be rude."
"Oh, I wouldn't worry about it. He'll get over it. He takes offence at everything these days. I asked him what he wanted for his birthday last week, and he just sneered and said a new teddy bear."
"Get him a really hairy one. He's obviously into that." "I don't think he was serious."
"He might have been. Lots of grown men have a teddy bear. I know a fellow who carries a Pooh Bear with him everywhere he goes and dresses him up in appropriate clothing on national holidays. It's a comfort thing."
"Trust me, he didn't mean it. He was just being snarky." "You said that you'd made some changes to your living arrangements?" I said, trying to get things back on track.
"What sort of changes?"
"Oh, yes. Well, the thing is, I've moved someone in," she said. "A man."
"What sort of a man?"
"What do you mean, what sort of a man? What kind of question is that?"
"Are you saying that you've moved a boyfriend in?"
"I am, yes."
"Problem?" "Need I remind you that you're still married to me?"
"Is that another one of your jokes?"
"It is," I said.
"Well, I'm very happy for you, Alice. It's about time you shacked up with someone."
"What's this fella's name, and are his intentions honourable towards you?"
"You promise you won't laugh?"
"Why would I laugh?" I asked.
"His name's Cyril."
I couldn't help myself. I laughed.
"You've got to be kidding me," I said. "The only two men in Dublin named Cyril, and you end up with both of them?"
"I didn't end up with you, Cyril," she pointed out. "I barely got to the starting line, remember? And look, it's just a rather awful coincidence, so please don't make a fuss about it. It's embarrassing enough as it is. All my friends already think he's a homosexual. It's not the name that's gay, you know. No, they think Cyril is you, and that we've got back together. Would you like that, Alice?"
"I'd rather bore a hole to the center of the earth with my tongue."
"Why, would you?"
"Very much. I miss your body."
"Oh, shut up! But if Charles moves in here, you are not allowed to make fun of Cyril."
"I'll probably have to," I said. "It's too good an opportunity to pass up."
"So what does he do?" "Cyril, too."
"Don't call him that."
"And he plays violin with the RT Symphony Orchestra."
"Very posh."
"Is he age-appropriate?"
"Not really. He's only just turned 40.
7 years younger," I said. "Good work.
And how long has he been living in our marital home, cuckolding me?"
"It's not our marital home. It might have been if you hadn't run off to Dublin Airport screaming like a girl. And he's been here slightly over 2 months.
Does Liam like him?"
"He does, actually."
"Has he actually said that, or are you just saying it to annoy me?"
"A little of both."
"Well, I have to say, I'm surprised, because as far as I can tell, Liam doesn't like anyone."
"Well, he likes Cyril."
"Good for Cyril. I can't wait to meet him."
"I don't think there'll be any need for that."
"Will you mind your father-in-law moving in? A cuckoo in the nest, so to speak."
"It's not a nest. It's a house. And don't call Charles my father-in-law. It's irritating. And no, Cyril won't mind. He's very easygoing for a violinist."
And so a few days later, my adoptive father returned to the first-floor room that had been his when I was a child. Although now, instead of being out in the city carousing with women until the small hours of the morning, he kept to his bed and began fulfilling his last major ambition in life, to work his way through all of Maud's novels in chronological order.
"I only ever read one when she was alive," he told me one afternoon during one of his more lucid moments, which seemed to come and go with alarming frequency. "And I remember at the time thinking that it was terribly good. I told her that it was the sort of book that could get made into a film if it found its way into the hands of a David Lean or a George Cukor, and she replied that if I ever said anything that crass about her work again, she would put arsenic in my tea. Not that I ever knew that much about literature, you understand, but I could tell that she had something."
"Most people seem to think so," I said.
"I've made a very good living from her, I have to admit. That will all be yours soon."
I looked at him in surprise.
"What did you say?" I asked. "Well, you're my next of kin, aren't you? Legally speaking. I've left everything to you, including the rights to Maud's books."
"You haven't.
But that's millions. I can change it if you like. There's still time. I could give it to one of those homeless charities, or leave it to Bono, because I'm sure he'd know what to do with it."
"No, no," I said quickly. "Don't do anything hasty. I'll take care of the homeless charities myself when the time comes, and Bono can probably take care of himself."
"Good old Maud," he said, smiling. "Who knew that a writer could actually make such a good living? And they say that the world is full of Philistines. Your wife wrote her thesis on her, didn't she?"
"She did," I admitted. "She even turned it into a book. But it's probably best not to call Alice my wife. She really doesn't care for it."
"I must have a chat with her about the novels, because reading them now, one by one, I can finally see what all the fuss is about. The only thing I'd tell Maud, if she was here, is that she runs the risk of sounding a little anti-man at times. Don't you agree? All the husbands in her novels are stupid, insensitive, faithless individuals with murky pasts, empty heads, micro-penises, and questionable morals. But I suppose she had a good imagination, as all writers must, and she was simply making things up.
I seem to recall that she didn't have a very good relationship with her father. Perhaps that's come into play in her work a little bit.
That must be it, I told him. I can't think where else she might have got such ideas.
Did your wife mention that in her biography?
A little bit, yes.
Did she mention me in her biography?
Of course.
How did I come out of it?
Not well, I said. But perhaps a little better than expected.
All right. How about you? Were you in it?
Yes.
How did you come out of it?
Not well, I said. Perhaps a little worse than expected.
Such is life. By the way, he said, I don't mean to sound indelicate, but I'm finding it a little hard to sleep with the constant sounds of lovemaking coming from your bedroom. Last night I woke up to hear your wife screaming your name out in rapturous pleasure with all the passion of a young nymphomaniac let loose in the dressing room of an under-17 boys' football team.
Good for you, my boy, especially after all these years.
I admire your ardour.
But if you could keep it down a little, I'd appreciate it. I'm a dying man, and I need my sleep. Actually, I don't think that was my name she was calling, I said.
Oh, it was. It certainly was, he insisted. I heard it over and over again. Oh, God, Cyril. Yes, Cyril. Right there, Cyril. Don't worry. That happens to everyone sometimes, Cyril.
That's not me, I told him. That's Cyril, too. The boyfriend. I haven't actually met him yet, but I'm assuming that you have.
Tall, miserable-looking streak of piss.
I don't know, but let's assume so.
Yes, I've met him. He looks in on me every so often and shouts at me as if I'm deaf, the way English people do with foreigners, because they think it'll make them understand them better.
He told me that he was playing Pugni's La Esmeralda all week in the National Concert Hall, and I just shook his hand and said, good for you.
A nurse came to visit every second morning to check up on him, and most afternoons Alice would take him for a walk around Dartmouth Square. As it became clear that he was reaching the end, however, I asked Alice whether I might move in, too, so that I could be with him when he departed this life for the next.
What? She said,
looking at me with an expression on her face that suggested she was astonished that I would even ask such a thing.
The thing is, I explained,
if he were to take a turn for the worse, you'd have to phone me, and by the time I got here, he might already be gone. But if I was already here, that wouldn't happen, and there's the added advantage that I could help you with his care.
You've done so much for him as it is. You must get exhausted.
What with your job, and looking after Liam, and having raucous sex with Cyril, too. She stared out the window as if she was trying to think of a good reason to say no.
But where would I put you? She asked.
Well, it's not as if it's a small house, I said. I could take the room at the top, the one that was mine when I was a boy.
Oh, no, she said.
I haven't been up there in so long. It's probably very dusty. I consider that part of the house to be closed.
Well, I could reopen it.
And I'd be happy to clean it up myself. Look, if you'd rather I didn't, then that's fine. If you don't want Charles to spend his last moments on Earth with his son, adoptive son, then I can't blame you. It would be totally understandable. But if not, then I really would like to.
And what about Cyril? She asked.
I am Cyril. You don't have a brain tumor too, do you?
My Cyril. I thought I was your Cyril. You see, this is why it will never work.
Cyril too, that's who you're talking about, is it?
Stop calling him that.
Well, he'd have to be incredibly insecure to be threatened by me, I said. I am, as has been clearly established by this stage, not exactly a ladies' man. Look, I know it would be an unconventional arrangement, but it wouldn't be for very long. I won't cause any trouble, I promise.
Of course you will, she said. You always cause trouble. That's your role in life. And I don't know what Liam would say.
He'd probably be very happy to have his mummy and daddy together under the same roof at last.
You see? I haven't even said yes yet, and you're already causing trouble with your little jokes.
I just want to be with him, I said quietly. Charles, I mean.
I've made a mess of most of my relationships, and it's been a strange one between the two of us, but I'd like it to end well, if possible.
Fine, she said, throwing her hands in the air. But this won't be a long-term arrangement, as long as you understand that. When he's gone, you're gone too.
I'll take a lift from the undertaker as he carries the box out the door, I said. Promise.
That night, when Liam returned home, he seemed startled to find both his parents eating dinner together in front of Coronation Street.
What's this?
He asked, stopping in the centre of the kitchen and staring at us both.
What's going on?
Everything's changed, I told him. We're getting back together.
We're even thinking of having another child.
You'd like a little brother or sister, wouldn't you?
Shut up, Cyril, said Alice. Don't worry, Liam. Your father was just teasing.
Don't call him that, said Liam.
Cyril is just teasing you, then. He's moving in while your grandfather is still with us.
Oh, all right, he said.
But why?
To help out.
I can help out, he said.
You can, said Alice, but you don't.
It won't be for long, I told him. And he is my father, after all.
Adoptive father, said Liam.
Well, yes, I said. But still, the only father I've ever known.
And what about Cyril? He asked.
What about me?
No, the other Cyril.
Cyril too.
Stop calling him that, said Alice. Cyril is fine with it. He'll be home soon, and I'll make the introductions then.
Liam shook his head and walked over to the fridge and began building a mountainous sandwich.
I don't know what to think, he remarked.
For years it was just the two of us, and now the house is full of men.
Full of Cyrils, I said.
It's hardly full of men, said Alice.
There's just two of them.
Three, said Liam.
You're forgetting Charles.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Four, if you include yourself, I pointed out to him. The number just keeps growing, doesn't it?
You're not to go anywhere near my room. Is that understood? He said, glaring at me.
I'll try to resist the overwhelming urge, I replied. A couple of hours later, Cyril too arrived home, and we shook hands as Alice stood between us, looking extremely flustered. He was a pleasant enough fellow, I thought, if a little dull. Within 5 minutes, he asked me whether I had a favourite symphony, and if I did, would I like him to play it as an anthem of welcome to Dartmouth Square? I told him that I didn't, but thanked him for the thought. That was him for the night, other than to ask me whether I knew a good cure for bunions. A week later, as I made my way upstairs to my bedroom with a mug of hot milk close to midnight, I heard crying coming from Charles's room. And I listened to the door for a few moments before tapping quietly and walking in. He was sitting up in bed with Maud's final novel by his side, wiping his eyes. "Are you all right?" I asked.
"I'm feeling very sad," he said, nodding towards the book. "That's the last one, you see. I've read them all now, so I think I'll probably be gone soon. There's nothing left." I wish I'd realized at the time how much talent she had. I wish I'd praised her more and been a better husband to her. She was so tired of life by the end, and tired of me. I treated her poorly. You didn't know her in the '30s, of course, but when she was a young woman she was full of fun. Spirited is the word people used back then. The type who would jump over streams and not think anything of it. The type who carried a hip flask in her handbag and took it out for a swig if the Sunday sermon went on too long.
I smiled. I found it hard to imagine Maud doing anything of the sort.
You know she assaulted the man from the revenue after you went to prison the first time, I said.
Did she? Why?
She said that he'd worked so hard to prosecute you that her name was in all the papers, and the result was that Amongst Angels had reached number 4 on the bestseller charts. She slapped him in the middle of the forecourts.
That was a blow to her, all right, he said, nodding. I remember her being very upset about it. She wrote me a letter afterwards,
and it wasn't pleasant, although it was incredibly well written.
Is she upstairs, Cyril?
Why not ask her to come down, and I'll try to make amends to her before I go to sleep?
No, Charles, I said, shaking my head. No, she's not upstairs.
She is. She must be.
Please send her down. I want to tell her that I'm sorry.
I reached out and brushed a strand of long white hair from his forehead back across his head. The skin was cold and clammy to the touch. He lay back down and closed his eyes, and I waited with him until he was asleep before going to bed myself. Lying in that single bed, looking through the skylight at the stars above, the same stars that I had stared at more than 40 years earlier, dreaming about Julian Woodbead and the things I wanted to do to him. And I understood at last why Charles had wanted to come back here. For the first time in my life, I started to think about my own mortality. Should I fall or have a heart attack, I could lie on the kitchen floor decomposing for weeks before anyone thought to come looking for me. I didn't even have a cat to eat me. Charles lasted another 4 days and, with impeccable timing, passed away when Alice, Liam, Cyril too, and I all happened to be at home. He'd been rambling all day, and it was clear that he didn't have long left, although he didn't think it would be just yet. Alice and I were downstairs preparing dinner when we heard Liam calling us from the floor above.
"Mom! Cyril! Come quick!"
All three of us ran upstairs and into the bedroom where Charles was lying with his eyes closed, his breathing slowing down. We could hear the effort it took for him to make every sound.
"What's happening?"
asked Liam. And it astonished me to see that my son, who had shown almost no emotion whatsoever in the time that I had known him, was close to tears, particularly since he hadn't even met his grandfather until a few weeks earlier. "He's going," I said, sitting down and taking one of his hands while Alice took the other. From the hallway outside, I heard the sound of a maudlin violin tune being played and rolled my eyes. "Does he have to do that?" I asked.
"Shut up, Cyril," said Alice. "He's only trying to help."
"Then couldn't he at least play something more cheerful, a jig or something?"
"Tell her it wasn't my fault,"
muttered Charles, and I bent my head down closer to his mouth.
"What wasn't your fault?" I asked, but he shook his head.
"Cyril,"
he said.
"What?"
"Come closer."
"I can't come any closer. We're practically kissing as it is."
He pulled himself up a little in the bed and looked around the room with a horrified expression on his pale face, before grabbing me by the back of the head and pulling my face close to him.
"You were never a real Avery," he hissed. "You know that, don't you?"
"I do," I said.
"Well, Christ on a bike, you came close. You came damn close."
And with that, he released me and fell back on his pillow, said nothing more, and we all watched as his breath slowed down until finally he was breathing no more. Somehow, I felt entirely removed from the scene at that moment, as if my own soul was ascending from my body towards the heavens. Looking down from above, I could see myself, my wife and son, sitting in the room over the remains of my adoptive father, and I thought, what a strange family I had grown up in, and what a peculiar one I would leave behind one day. 2 days later, we buried him in the church graveyard at Ranelagh, and when we returned to Dartmouth Square, Alice sat me down and said that she was happy that I'd been there towards the end, and pleased that she'd been able to help, but that was it. She didn't want any misunderstandings between us, and I would have to go home now.
"But I don't even own a cat," I said.
"What has that got to do with anything?"
"Nothing," I said.
And of course I must go. You've been very kind to me, you and Cyril too.
Don't.
Sorry. I slept there one final night, and early the following morning packed the few personal items and clothes that I had brought with me, and left the house for good.